ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
What happens when machine merges with man to create an entirely new species? It's an ethical crisis closer than you think. This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. That story is soon. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has backed down after protests from the Vatican and the governments of France, Italy, even the United States. They were upset that Israeli police had blocked the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pisabella, from entering the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. After Israel's President Isaac Herzog intervened, Netanyahu said the cardinal would have access to all the holy sites this Easter. Now, in the near future, artificial intelligence could do the thinking and a robotic combination of human and machine do the lifting. But it's a dystopic prospect. The poor, the weak, and those who simply believe in humanity as nature intended it could be abandoned. These are just some of the extraordinary ethical problems of so-called transhumanism. Professor Jason E. Burl is a bioethicist at St. Louis University in Missouri. He's in Australia next week to deliver the annual lecture for the Plunkett Center for Ethics.
There are some ways in which we're already engaging in technological manipulations of the human body. I mean, a lot of this is therapeutic, right? These are good things. So we talk about, you know, pharmaceuticals or body prostheses. There's been so many technologies developed, particularly to help people with disabilities, that for others who don't have a particular disability, that same technology could be a form of enhancement. Body prosthetics, pharmaceuticals, and then you think about things like CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, neural implants are being developed, brain-computer interface devices. Every day there's new technologies coming onto the scene that are being researched right now that could help further the transhumanist aim.
Yeah. Are these not technologies, though, Jason, that are designed to restore the body to its full capacity, perhaps in the way that nature intended? I mean, these technologies that you've mentioned, particularly prosthetics, but also, as you say, there are some brain implants that can help people who are dealing with Parkinson's disease. They're about restoring humanity, aren't they? Not designed to alter it, are they?
The question about design is really kind of in the intention of the designer. And yes, the primary goal in developing most of these technologies is therapeutic, but at least some of the designers may also have transhumanist aims in mind as well. And of course, a lot of this depends on, of course, what we mean by human nature. And if you ask a transhumanist, they would say there's no such thing. But even setting that aside, there's all sorts of questions about how we draw a line, or can we draw a line between therapy and enhancement? And this question of what nature intends, how do we discern what that is?
Well, how do we discern what that is? I mean, can we discern what nature intends? Most of us, I guess, would assume that what nature intends is the body as we've understood it for thousands of years. I mean, is there a question as to what nature intends?
Yes, in the sense that the body is a product of biological evolution. And of course, some people deny that, but at least from my perspective as a Catholic, Catholics accept the reality of biological evolution. And of course, that's a blinded process that we can't control. And so, you know, at least what the transhumanists want is for us to take over and exercise that rational control. What I would say in response to that is, yes, we're products of evolution. Yes, evolution is the blinded process. But there is clearly certain ways in which the current form of the human body is either in a state of health or in a state of unhealth. Yes, there may be some gray areas, some blurred boundaries, but I also think we have sort of clear examples at different ends of the spectrum of what would be an enhancement that fully transcends human nature and things that are fully clearly in accord with human nature.
Yeah, so give us an example of something that crosses a line, Jason, because this is the essence of what you do as an ethicist, as a philosopher. What would be a transhumanist development that would cross a line in your view?
Any technology which gives a human being a whole new capacity which no member of the human species possesses. One example that sometimes gets tossed around is genetically modifying human beings to develop the echolocation capability that bats have. That's not one of our five senses, but the idea would be if that could be valuable for some people, I guess cave spelunkers or something, or deep sea divers. You know, whether it's morally permissible or not, that's a separate question, but whether it crosses the line of clearly not being part of human nature, that would be one example. Another example at the far end of transhumanist aspirations is to, if this were technically, metaphysically achievable, which I doubt, completely digitize human consciousness, to upload human consciousness into the cloud or into a cybernetic device, into an android body, into another cloned body. At least some transhumanists, like Ray Kurzweil, think that within probably the next couple decades, we'll achieve this. But that would be completely shedding what is essential, I think, to being human, which is to be this enfleshed, embodied animal of the species Homo sapiens. Mm.
What would that mean to upload human consciousness to the cloud in a practical way? And what sort of power would that confer on people who control the cloud?
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. On the one hand, it seems like if this transhuman aspiration were achievable, which, as I said, I doubt, but if it were, would that be desirable to just be a disembodied consciousness? Yes, it might grant you a type of longevity. You can outlast your body, sure, but there would still be this sort of existential dependence on the servers or whatever mechanical devices, which, as you know, are all going to be invented things that are going to have patents that are owned by companies. And so you're really surrendering your entire being over to whoever controls this technology. Even if it were possible, I really question that that would be a desirable state of existence.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, Jason, something that some advocates of transhumanism either forget or conveniently push aside. And that is this question of socioeconomic justice, because I'm assuming that transhumanist technologies are very expensive. Only some people will be able to afford to enhance themselves physically, intellectually. What does that do to the already yawning chasm in socioeconomics?
In my view, it'll only exacerbate it. This is a widely voiced critique of transhumanism or just human enhancement more broadly, that it'll widen the gulf between the so-called haves and have-nots. I use a lot of pop culture in my teaching. There's a wonderful movie from the late 90s called Gattaca. In that film, it's set in the near future, and through genetic selection, you have these sort of genetically perfect members of society, and then you have this minority underclass of people whose parents, for whatever reason, did not decide to create them using genetic selection and gene editing technologies. Yeah, it's very clear who, you know, gets to have the top jobs and go to university and who are, again, this sort of servile underclass of society. Mm-hmm. So even if some of these forms of enhancement were, you know, I draw a distinction between, in principle, could this be permissible? Sure, maybe some of these enhancement technologies would, in principle, be okay for us to do, for someone to choose for themselves. But in practice, because of things like this justice question you're raising, we ought not to do it.
We already do this, though, to some extent. This is one of the factors, for example, in surrogacy. I read accounts repeatedly of people seeking to choose the biological mother of their surrogate child, and they literally look at things like the woman's appearance, like her IQ, to some extent, her family background, almost shopping for the perfect set of genes. We do this, don't we?
We have. And just to give voice to both sides of the equation, a standard argument in defense of that practice is, how is this any different from sizing someone up in a bar or dance club and deciding whether you're going to go home with them or date them or marry them or have children with them? That then led to a sort of medicalized version of this, first with sperm donors. And again, there's these catalogs where people look at all these qualities, and now egg donors, which I don't agree with, but that is the idea that we've always kind of done this. My counter argument to that is, having bureaucratized this, medicalized this, it does betray this sort of eugenic mentality. There's a long history of eugenics in the early 20th century. Yes, to some extent, we are biologically driven to find mates, to reproduce with people that we naturally see are genetically compatible. But then to make a science out of that, now we're talking about controlling human life and exercising the control of the next generation. And it's that usurping of that power that I think now crosses sort of certain ethical lines.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report, with me, Andrew West, here on ABC Radio National, I'm speaking with Jason Eberl. He's a professor at St. Louis University. Jason is a world-renowned bioethicist. It's also about, though, the economic commodification of the body as well. I mean, that has been part of the critique of something like surrogacy. I'm wondering how that now extends to transhumanism. We are essentially seeing the body as just another machine?
As both a machine and, as you said, a commodity. In the U.S., I think in most places in the world, selling of human organs for transplant is an ethical line no one thinks we should cross. A few people have argued we can cross it. But in general, we kind of respect this idea that if you're going to, say, donate your organs to help save someone's life, that should be just that, a donation, a free gift. You know, we think it's heroic. But then when it comes to other bodily products, again, sperm, eggs, blood plasma even, those people can sell. Yeah, I would want to personally draw a hard line against commodification of any of these parts of the body. There's further ethical questions about, particularly in the realm of reproduction, whether that should only be done, you know, in certain contexts, not in others. I just want to draw this line between commodifying the human body versus the technology. Yeah, technology is commodified. But then, of course, this line gets blurred when technologies, again, are invented, are under patents and so on, that are sold, are now being bought and integrated within our bodies.
Yeah, I also wonder about the effect on the human character. If we try to equalize everyone's strengths, everyone's intellect, what happens to the human character when the strong are no longer called upon to assist the weak, when the intelligent are no longer called upon to be in service to the rest of the community? What happens there? Because, yes, there are unequal distributions of intelligence, of physical strength, but ideally, the best of the human character puts those strengths at the service of others. What happens when all that's equalized?
That's a great question. Like I said, I'm Catholic, and I kind of think about these things primarily philosophically in ways that are rationally defensible through argumentation to those who don't share my religious worldview. But I also do some work in the specifically theological aspects of some of this. And it's interesting, I wrote a paper with my colleague, Miguel Romero, who's a disability theologian, another Catholic theologian. We were focusing on the notion of the, you know, sort of pre-fall humanity told through the story of the Garden of Eden, whether one takes that story literally or metaphorically or mythically. The idea being that when God created human beings, there were differences. Adam and Eve were not created to be immortal, hence they need to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. The forbidden fruit was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So the idea is that in humanity's unfallen condition, we are supposed to have these differences. And how we define, for example, disabilities or not disabilities, some of these things are simply different ways of being human. I do some work in that area, but I think it intersects in interesting ways with this question about human enhancement. If we're going to value enhancing certain human capacities, how can we square that with avoiding disvaluing the lives and experiences of persons with disabilities?
Jason, just as we wind up, to what extent have certain developments in bioethics, I'm thinking particularly of transgender treatments, we've mentioned surrogacy, to what extent have they actually paved the way for a transhumanist future?
In some ways, there is sort of a similar underlying philosophical, metaphysical, moral mindset between the idea of transgender identity and transhumanism. This is a debated point, but for example, Martine Rothblatt, who is transgender, is the founder of Sirius XM Radio, has publicly linked the two, at least for Rothblatt, the fundamental ethos of transgenderism, which is exercising biotechnological control over one's body, in this case, perhaps for therapeutic reason, to overcome gender dysphoria, not necessarily for an enhancement reason. But it's still the sort of same idea. If one's body is in some sense unsatisfactory to a person, one can, again, use biotechnology to shape one's body, or again, if one goes as far as someone like Ray Kurzweil, to leave one's body behind altogether. If you're transgendered, that doesn't mean you're a transhumanist. I'm not saying that. But I do think that, to use your language, of paving the way, there's a sort of fundamental philosophical line that you connect the two.
It's a fascinating connection. Interestingly, it's made in a recent book by Paul Kingsnorth, Against the Machine, on the Unmaking of Humanity. And that also carries, I think, a rather prophetic quote from the American novelist Wendell Berry. He says, "It's easy for me to imagine that the next great division of the world will be between people who wish to live as creatures and people who wish to live as machines." Professor Jason Eberl, he's from St. Louis University, where he's one of the world's leading bioethicists. Jason is coming to Australia to deliver a lecture on the 8th of April at the Plunkett Centre for Ethics. We'll put a link to that at our website. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're with me, Andrew West, on ABC Radio National, hearing about the links between religion, ethics, and the news that shapes the world. An Australian bishop is set to take up a top Vatican job. Pope Leo has announced Anthony Randazzo of the Broken Bay Diocese will become the new prefect of the Dicastery for Legislative Texts. That means he'll be responsible for interpreting and applying church law throughout the Catholic world. He'll become the most senior Australian cleric in the Vatican since the late George Pell, who was prefect for the economy. And the Pope had some pointed words for the residents of the world's wealthiest state this week. In a day-long visit to Monaco, where one in three people are millionaires, Leo condemned, quote, the idolatry of power and money. He also reminded them Jesus was an advocate for the poor and the outcast. Each Easter, we bring you stories from places where war and other disasters can try a person's faith, but where, despite the despair, their religious beliefs survive. Asuntha Charles has worked with the faith-based aid organisation World Vision. She's been in Afghanistan under the Taliban and in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. That's where 1.1 million Rohingya Muslims fled the military regime in Myanmar, Burma. She was in Australia recently with the Mica Women's Network.
I can never forget those moments because I was just staying at my guest house. I could hear my security guards telling me that the Taliban are taking over Kabul and the airport was in a chaotic situation. I just wanted to see what's happening around. I asked my driver and the security guard to accompany me, and we were just moving into the airport. I could see people were beaten up because they were just rushing to the airport just to get a flight to move out of the country. I could see the frustration. I could see children running everywhere looking for a place for safety. Just the families trying to protect their children. It was an extremely a challenging situation to see people just running around and looking for places of safety.
Yeah, most of the aid community and the international relief community felt they had to leave for their own safety. Why didn't you, though?
I felt if I have to serve people, how can I leave them when they need me the most? Because these are the challenging moments, including my staff, they're desperate. If I leave the country, that sends very wrong signals that World Vision, as a Christian organization, will not be there when people need us the most. So I really wanted to give a positive note and a hope to people. The organization will be there where the need is huge.
Did you think of it as being brave, though? Were you conscious at the time that what you were doing was a fairly risky proposition for you?
I was totally aware of what was happening and how risky it would be for me as a woman, as a leader of a Christian organization. But somewhere I felt that's what I'm supposed to do as a leader.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm expected as a leader of an organization, to stand by the people.
How do you think the Taliban perceived the work of foreign aid organizations, especially Christian organizations? Because I think Afghanistan is something like a 98% Muslim country. While it has lots of ethnic and tribal diversity, it is not a religiously diverse country. I'm just wondering how you think a fundamentalist organization like the Taliban thought of a Christian organization. Were they suspicious of what are you doing in Afghanistan?
Actually, we kept our communications very transparent. And from the beginning, we were very clear what we are doing on the ground. As a child-focused organization, everybody knew that we are there in Afghanistan to support the children. And that constant messaging, that transparency and accountability helped us a lot. Even Taliban knew, because we were also working in many of those areas, but they knew us as an organization working for children. And that credibility actually helped us to move into areas that no organization could go.
Did you find yourself, though, having to not suppress, but maybe be a little less open about your identity as a Christian organization?
I don't think so. We were always mentioning and calling ourselves as World Vision a child-focused organization.
Yeah.
So that's why we maintained that kind of a communication to every stakeholder. So children were our focus, nothing else.
Yeah. What were the challenges that the children faced, particularly after the Taliban's return to power? There was a sense that there had been, well, not a very easy 20 years, but a 20 years in which women and girls had made some advances. What were the fears when the Taliban returned to power?
The main fear was the freedom for women, because they knew what had happened before 20 years, how educational opportunities, employment opportunities were totally not reaching them, and they were fearful. They thought they are going to lose the opportunity to learn, because many Afghan girls were studying. They were lawyers, doctors. They were in influential positions. Once Taliban were coming back, that was the strongest fear that they would disappear from the society.
What signs of resilience did you see among those women and girls, given that society was closing in on them again? I'm assuming that just because the government changes, their aspirations and their hopes don't change.
I always marvel at the spirit of every Afghan woman and girl child. They are finding ways and means to keep those aspirations alive. I am connected with some of them, and I still see that spirit for growth, spirit for aspirations, and they have never given up. That is why I admire Afghan women and Afghan girls.
I'm wondering now, realistically, how women can prosper, women can advance in that society. I know you're still in touch, as you say, with many of the women there. I'm just wondering what the realistic prospects are.
This situation is not new for women, especially for Afghan women. They faced a similar situation before the Taliban period. And even those days, they studied. This situation is also similar to that. Every organization present in Afghanistan is trying to see how we can support women to learn, to be employed. These are the constant struggles that every organization goes through so that women don't disappear from the society.
Have things settled as best as you can ascertain? I mean, is there a realistic streak among some people in the Taliban that you can't eliminate the talents and the contribution of 50% of the population? I mean, is there any shard of light there?
That's the positive thing that I see. Like, as soon as Taliban taking over, it was not like the previous time. There were also progressive thinking Taliban who wanted women to study. They were also against schools being closed. So there are people who give us the hope that things will go in the right direction.
Take us to another very challenging location. It's Cox's Bazar. It's in Bangladesh. It's on the border with Myanmar, Burma. Most of the refugees there were Rohingya Muslims.
Yeah.
In the midst of a very desperate situation, I think at one point there was 1.1 million refugees from Myanmar, Burma. What gave you hope in that circumstance? Because to those who looked from outside, it looked like a place of utter despair.
I lived there for nearly 1 year supporting the Rohingyas. I know how difficult it is to stay on in those camps. 33 camps in a very small geographical area, 1.1 million people, and 50% of them not children. It's a painful situation to see how people struggle every day. Even for water, privacy is a question. And especially the lives of women turns out to be a bigger challenge in those circumstances.
Yeah, I'm wondering why women are disproportionately affected as refugees.
In any disaster, women and children become the most vulnerable people because they really hold on to so many responsibilities. They also take care of the family, they want to take care of the children, they want to protect everyone. It's not only within the family, but they also want to take care of their neighbors.
Yeah.
It's easy for somebody to escape alone, but I'm sure women will not do that. They will carry their children with them.
Yeah. Pope Francis, I think, said that he saw the face of Christ in a Rohingya child, a Rohingya Muslim child. Do you recall that statement?
Yes. The Pope visited Cox's Bazar and he met the Rohingya children. And what he said is the real truth. And every child brings out so much of innocence. And it is so pathetic to see that they are losing their childhood. Because they are in a place which doesn't belong to them. They are in a place where they cannot have their rights. And that innocence is what I'm sure Pope calls it as a face of Christ.
Yeah.
He's right.
Your new appointment to head World Vision based in the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, to some people it might seem a much easier task. But what's the challenges that you think you'll have to deal with in the South Pacific?
Yeah, the challenges are different, but the challenges are there. That's what I would say.
Sure.
Maybe it's not war and it's not the refugees, it's not people getting killed that I see, but I see children getting affected by the impact of climate change. Their lives are being threatened. Their dreams are getting destroyed because the climate is really pulling away all that is really close to their heart. Their land is being taken away. Agriculture is not becoming productive. Sea is not productive. So the natural resources which were so close to their heart is drying up.
Asunta Charles, she's the new National Director of World Vision for the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
And that's it for this episode. You can follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Mandy Roberts and Antonia Gauci. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.